Many of you know that I was raised, Linda, as well, in the Niagara region. And as a young boy, I was captivated by the stories of the great Niagara daredevils. Primary amongst them, top of the table, was none other than the French 19th century Charles Blondin, and he was an acrobat and tightrope walker. He had done a tour of the United States, and whilst on tour in late 1858, he came to Niagara Falls for the first time and was captivated by it and said, "I must cross this river," and not in a standard way, of course. Made his plans, and by 30th of June, 1859, he did the first tightrope walk across the Niagara River. And of course, there's no social media back then, there's no other entertainment. Records show close to 100,000 people would line the sides of the bank of the river to see this man do these stunts. Not just once, some say up to 300 times he crossed the river. That summer, I think it was nine alone and nine different occasions. And in increasingly challenging ways, shall we say, because of course the appetite of the braying masses is you've got to do more and better all the time. So he would cross not just forward, he'd cross backward, he would go over on stilts, he pushed a wheelbarrow across, he took a chair out, stood the chair on one leg, got on top of the chair. One time even took a little cook stove out with a frying pan, and being a Frenchman, cooked an omelet, dropped it down to the maid of the mist below. I don't know what he charged for that, but not enough. The most striking thing was when he took his manager, Harry, piggyback across the falls. This is with no safety net. All he's got is a balancing pole and the weight of his manager, Harry, on his back. And he says this to him as both warning and advice. "Look up, Harry. You are no longer Colcord. You are Blondin. If I sway, sway with me. Do not attempt to do any balancing yourself. If you do, we'll both go down to our death." I think it's one of the best examples of trust between humans. And really, in a sense, and we're thankful, actually, Harry did not do that, okay? Did not come down. Oh, I didn't say. I meant to say, what if, imagine if Harry had halfway over said, "You know what, thanks for taking me part way. I'm going to get down and handle the rest myself." He didn't do that. And of course, had he done that, would have been very foolish and 100% fatal. And in a way, this is what Paul's dealing with. He's dealing with how do we get to the other side in the Christian life. Context is when he's speaking to the Galatians, he's speaking to a very young collection of churches. You can read of his first missionary journey in Acts 13 and 14. We believe this is when he preached in especially the southern regions of Galatia. People came to faith, established churches, but in very short order, they've been distracted away from the truth of the gospel. We see this right in chapter 1 when he says, right by verse 6, "I'm astonished that you're so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and turning to a different gospel," which he qualifies immediately, there's no other gospel. But you're listening to people who are distorting the true gospel of Christ. This is a bit personal for him, because these are his churches, in a sense, out of his first missionary efforts. And he wants to care for them. And so the rebuke on two occasions is quite striking. This one here, and what we just read from in chapter 3. He goes on to give his personal testimony. He affirms or asserts his apostleship, his calling before God, and then comes to the great central doctrinal truth of the gospel in that it is by faith and not works. We find out near the end of chapter 2. So that sets the setting for chapter 3. And this great opening line, but a striking one at the same time, "O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you?" In other words, he says to them, you're not thinking straight. You're not thinking straight. It's like you're under a spell. This word bewitched, that gives us already that impression. More pointedly in the Greek, it's the impression, I'm going to be very careful where I look here, of giving someone the evil eye. And so it's, I didn't look at anyone, did I? And giving someone the evil eye, and that's what has captivated their eyes. They've taken their gaze away from something true and right, and it's now distracting them and distorting their understanding of the gospel. This is why in verse 2, he calls attention to their eyes. This is what you ought to be looking at. He says, it was before your eyes that Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified. Now, how in the world did they see Christ as crucified? Surely it's highly unlikely that any of them had seen the crucifixion of Christ, being Gentiles from Galatia. No, they had seen the crucifixion of Christ because of Paul's faithful preaching. It was publicly done and publicly portrayed. That word portrayed is like he's placarded the gospel. He's put it on a billboard for all to see. The Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. That's what Paul had done through his faithful preaching. And they believed it. Evidently, they came to faith. And yet, at the same time, they're challenged to maintain that trust in Christ. He points to their own experiences rhetorically. He asks questions like, did you receive God's Spirit by works of the law or faith? He asks, if God has started your new life in him by the Spirit, do you really think he's going to finish it by the flesh? He lays out these alternatives. The work to complete us is either in faith and spirit or by law and flesh. And in short, then, these first five verses show that, in Paul's opinion, that it's not just the gospel, or the gospel not merely saves us, but it's also the means through which we grow. We never outgrow the gospel. We never abandon the gospel. We never say to the gospel, you've taken me halfway across this tightrope, the tightrope of my life, and I'm going to take it from here. And this is really, I think, the crux of the issue for Paul, in that the question is, how do we make ourselves acceptable to God? These false teachers have been enticing the Galatians. This enticement was that they could be a better Christian, that they would receive the fullness of the promises, even all the promises of Abraham. But surely, if you're going to receive these blessings of Abraham, you must be a proper son of Abraham. And in their opinion, a proper son would be one that did certain things. So I think the conversation probably went something like this with these teachers. They had a little checkbook, and they brought it out, and they interviewed people, and they said, you know, are your men circumcised, yes or no? Let me look at your calendars, your daytimers, as it were. Have you got the right holidays blocked off? And surely you're eating kosher food, right? This is not looking good for you, 0 for 3. And so that was the test, and they were laying this before them, that to be true sons of Abraham, to be the best Christians, you had to submit to some works that would essentially make them Jewish, live Jewish lives. And so, probably not super surprising that he does turn to Abram. I think there are a couple of surprises in this text. One is just the strength of his rebuke. I've tried to sort of give you some of the context to understand just why is he bringing such vehemence, as it were, to the problem? And then secondly, this allusion to Abraham, the drawing from Abraham, for example, even saying the shocking thing that the gospel itself was somehow preached to Abraham. So let's unpack that a little bit for ourselves, and I think we'll see some understanding that helps us in our life and our appreciation for the gospel as well. Paul appeals to Abraham, and I really do think this is brilliant. He takes on these false teachers, who wants the new believers, these precious new believers, to live as Jews. Well, who is the father of all Jews? He's Abraham. And so in a way, he's calling to the dock, the star witness for the other team, to make his own case. Absolutely brilliant. And why is Abraham so commended? We read of him in Hebrews 11, right? The great hall of faith, as we call it. And he gets more ink in chapter 11 than anyone else. Paul devotes a chapter in his great theological treatise to the book to the Romans. Chapter 4 is about Abraham and his faith. Why in this letter, when defending the gospel, does he reach back through nearly 2,000 years of biblical history to appeal to Abraham? Well, because, quite simply, the text says it, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. Paul starts with their experience, saying, hey, don't forget how you started. Don't forget what brought you here, all right? But now he's going to turn to the scriptures and Abraham to continue to explain, defend, and proclaim the gospel. And he does this more than any other New Testament author. So again, it's striking that, you know, this gospel proclamation that we often think of in terms of event, the event of the cross, and of course that's the means through which the gospel promise is effected. But Paul very clearly says it's more than that. Before it was an event, the gospel was a promise. The gospel was a promise. This is the promise that we read in Genesis 12, verse 3. It's reiterated in chapter 15 and chapter 17. It's the promise that is also given to Abram's son Isaac and Isaac to Jacob. It becomes this linchpin, if it were, the backbone of Genesis itself, and really throughout the Old Testament, a touch point, an anchor for their souls that there is this great promise of God. And so I think, again, it's not surprising that Paul in the New Testament turns our attention back to the Old. He goes back to this first promise. Interestingly, in Genesis 12, we think obviously the cross is the center of all history. Every hope, past and future, centers itself upon either forward-looking or backward-looking upon the cross. But Genesis 12 in itself is another interesting time in history. Think about what has happened. We know the story of the original sin. We see that in Genesis chapter 3. 4 to 11 is really the outworking or the consequences of that sin in the world. We see the breakdown of relationships, Cain and Abel in chapter 4. We see the growing corruption the Bible speaks of in chapters 5 and 6 and leading to the flood with Noah. We see the corruption of men's minds and how it affects their motivations and ambitions with the building of the Tower of Babel. And that brings us to the end of 11. And what is God going to do about the chaos? You know, he has spoken the world into being, bringing order out of chaos. That's what Genesis 1 tells us. And now, because of man, there is chaos again. What will the Lord do about it? And so he takes this man named Abram, foreign to us in so many ways. He's from a place called Ur of Chaldees, 4,000 years ago. And he says to him, I'm going to be a blessing to the very nations of the world through you. Gives him a promise. This is how the world will be made right. And I think this is why Paul takes our attention then to Abraham. There still is a need for the world to be made right. And so how are we encouraged in the gospel by Paul's use of this promise, this ancient promise? Well, I'm looking at three ways this morning. I want to consider three reasons Paul frames up the gospel with the promise to Abraham. So let's cast our eyes again to verses 7 to 9. It reads, know then that those of faith who are the sons of Abraham, it is those of faith who are the sons of Abraham, and the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, in you shall all the nations be blessed. So then those who are of faith are blessed along with Abraham, the man of faith. So straight away he answers this question about who are the true sons of Abraham. These false teachers have been saying, you know, if you really want the fullest of the blessings, you want to be the top-notch, the blue-ribbon sheep Christian, then you better do these things. Paul immediately puts the lie to that and calls it out. He says, you're not a son of Abraham by your family background. You're not a son of Abraham by the tribe you're in, by your ethnicity, not even by the actions you take upon yourself. Nothing you can submit to makes you a son of Abraham. It's something you do, and that something is having faith. It is by faith that we are sons, true sons of Abraham. He goes on to say this striking statement, I think, that the gospel is preached to Abraham. Well, how is that done? How can we have the gospel being preached to Abraham before Christ, so long before Christ? Well, he says that it is because through this speaking of the promise to Abraham that the gospel is preached. God says, in you, through you, all the nations of the world would be blessed. And Paul says this is, in a sense, a proto-preaching, a first preaching of the gospel in Scripture. In you, all the nations will be blessed. And that blessing is the justification by faith of the Gentiles, of the nations. Paul says Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. Now note that Abraham didn't believe because he's a righteous man. This is really important to get the ordering right and the logic right here. He's not believing because he's righteous. He wasn't chosen because he was the best Jew on the face of the earth, and if I choose him, I know he's righteous, he'll believe. No, it was counted to him as righteousness. That counting has the sense of a status being given by God that he otherwise didn't have. So he believed God, then the Lord bestowed upon him, imputed to him, in the language of, say, Luther and the Reformers, a righteousness that he did not previously have. He believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. Let's consider what Abraham believed. Paul doesn't say Abraham believed in God. Now, he did. I'm not arguing that. He did believe in God. But that wasn't the basis of this counting as righteousness. It was what Abraham believed. You know, the devil believes in God, but it's not counted. That belief in God is not counted as righteousness for him. It is what Abraham believed. And what he believed specifically was God's promise. If you were to turn, or you can do it later today, to Romans 4, that chapter I mentioned before, it's all on Abraham and his faith. It said, commending him from 20 to 22, that Abraham grew strong in faith. He wavered not in unbelief, grew strong in faith, being fully persuaded. What fully persuaded him? That the God who made this promise to him was able and willing to keep it, and he would keep it. So that was the faith of Abraham. Paul even says explicitly in verse 22, that is why it was counted to him as righteousness. His faith was in God and not his own performance. You know, it's no different for us. There's a life and death difference between a general belief in God and believing God's gospel promise to us. Look, the Bible tells us, like I said, even the devils believe in God. And many people have this sort of a religious sense of duty toward God, a belief in God, but no sense of their need of God. I can speak to this, that in high school I had spent a couple of years thinking through religious themes and ideas, reading about different religions, different concepts of God, all that. And so I would have at that time said, I believe in God. But that belief was not saving belief. It's not justifying belief. That word justifying that Paul uses repeatedly in his epistles means to be right. What makes us right before God? It's a critical question. And it's one I think that gnaws at all of our souls until we answer it. That's why Augustine famously said, all our souls are restless until we find our rest in God, that trust in God. So it's not just merely believing in God. What flipped the switch for me was the same thing that's on Paul's mind. He wants them to keep the cross before their eyes, the death of this sacrificial, atoning death. And that's what flipped the switch for me, to move me simply from being, I guess in a technical term, a theist, one who believed God exists, but seeing actually that I need God. You know, before I saw my need of God, I was just on some self-improvement project. I thought I was a pretty good guy for believing in God, and he was, you know, and that simple belief in God was making me a better person. I was, you know, more mindful. Maybe I'd walk more old ladies across the street. I wouldn't look at certain girls the way I used to look at certain girls. It wasn't, as Paul works and makes very clear, that's all a work of the flesh, a work of the law, trying to externally change an internal problem. And so I still, even when I believed in God, I had a disposition against him. Until I saw the cross, until I saw the purpose of the cross and the necessity of the cross. And you don't see the necessity of the cross until you see God's holiness and your unholiness. And then the cross becomes the good news. The good news to the bad news that we are not good people. All right. This really leads to the next thing. So what does Paul want us to see? He wants us to trust the power of the gospel. He wants us to see the purpose of the gospel, and he wants us to see the power of the gospel. The power of the gospel we see in verses 10 through 14. He says, again, I just sort of touched on this already, so we can go through this a little quicker. All who rely on the works of the law are under a curse. Why are they under a curse? It's not that the law is a curse. The law is a blessing. But the fact that we cannot keep the law, that we're powerless, the law is powerless in itself to empower us to obey it. We all know that. Let alone God's perfect law. Let's just say the law of whoever. I won't name names. Okay? All you make up a law for yourself this week. This is what I'm going to do. Every jot and tittle of it, every minute of your day accounted for, every thought, every action, and have it to your standards. You will not meet that. In fact, you won't meet it. You'll probably break your own law within the first hour of the first day. We're not capable. We're not good. We like rules in a way, but we're not good at following them. And so this is why Paul is saying they're under a curse. He quotes from the Old Testament saying that cursed is everyone who does not abide by all the things written in the book. So if you're going to live under the law, and this is what perplexes him, he says, you know the truth of the gospel, and yet you've turned away. You've allowed these false teachers to distort the gospel, and now you're thinking that it's not only getting to God by faith, you've got to keep yourself in God by faith. And he's perplexed at how can you turn back again to the law? It's powerless. Those that live under it are in a sense saying, I'm going to be accountable to it. That's what that means, to live under the law. You're accountable then to it. And to be accountable to it means every jot and tittle of that law, of God's law, not just your lame law, you know, your lazy, lame law that you can't even keep. No, it's God's holy, perfect law. And so that is why they're under a curse. Now, the good news, of course, is that Christ has redeemed us from this curse. He became the curse for us. This is the power of the gospel, the beauty of the gospel as well, that he took upon himself our curse, gave to us his righteousness. Now, in the middle of this 10 to 14 passage is a great little statement, and it speaks again to the sustaining power of the gospel. And that is that the just live by faith. You almost think he's quoting himself from Romans, but Romans hasn't been written yet. 10 years away still. He's quoting Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4, the just live by faith. The Old Testament is full of the grace of God. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. We do not serve a dichotomy of gods, that one God of the Old Testament, one God of the New. We see the miracle-working grace of God in his redemption all the way through, and it's always based on God's grace and our faith, always. And so this call to live by faith recognizes that we need him. Just as we need breath every day, we need the power of the gospel to sustain us. It isn't just what gets us our ticket to heaven, as some may say. This is our very lifeblood. It's the lens through which we understand and comprehend everything is through the gospel. Thirdly, besides seeing the purpose of the gospel and trusting the power of the gospel for daily living, Paul wants us to understand the very nature of the gospel. And so he turns to an example. All right, I think he's probably quite surprised. He's astonished, as he says, that they're turning away from the power of the gospel. So he then gives them this human example. He says in verse 15, "Brothers, even with a man-made covenant, no one annuls it or adds to it once it has been ratified." Covenant, of course, is an agreement. It's an agreement between two parties. We sometimes think of wills as being covenants. They're maybe not the best example because, of course, you can write somebody out of a will these days. But something like an irrevocable trust, that's where the conditions and the terms of that trust, once they're signed, they're actually signed in stone. They're set in stone. They cannot be changed. That's what irrevocable means. That is the kind of covenant that Paul has in mind. And he has that in mind because that's the kind of God we have. He is not changeable. He is not one who is a man who would lie. He's the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega. He is always the same. And so his promises hold. But there's a challenge to those promises. Even that old promise of Abraham given in Genesis 12, 2,000 years before the time of Paul, it's being challenged because those false teachers have said to the Galatians, hey, wait a minute, there's the Mosaic law that comes. So Paul rightly shows them, hey, this is late to the party, 430 years late. So is God a covenant-keeping God or not? And of course he is. And so the fact that the law comes doesn't annul the first promise given. That stands. All right, that's why he's using that argument. Now, the law, it begs the question, why in the world do we have it then? That's for 19 and later, and that's another sermon. Okay, forget about that. Okay, read it yourself. But for his point at hand now, the law itself does not annul the promise to Abraham. Moreover, he's, I think, more concerned about the nature of the gospel being protected. And this is so important to understand the nature of the gospel, because it is not merely the understanding that gets us right with God. It's how do we live our life every day after that. Now, even getting right with God, if we don't understand the nature of God, we don't even get that right. I can remember being tasked during seminary, the church I was attending said, you know, we're putting all these people through an Alpha program and none of them are staying in church or coming to faith. Can you do something about that? And so, yeah, it's a great opportunity to run what they call the beta group. And I had about 12 people. The first week, I asked them a simple question, what is a Christian? And the answers were rubbish, absolute rubbish from some of the smartest people I've ever met. And so it then put the task before me. We're going to, you know, explain the gospel to these people. They have to know what they're rejecting. You know, often when I talk to people about the Christian faith and they have rejected it, what they're rejecting is not the Christian faith. They're rejecting some idol that they've put up, some misunderstanding. They don't understand the gospel. And so it's important not only for our own lives, it's important for how we share it as well, to get the nature of the gospel. And so this is what he's dealing with. And he walks through this argument that, you know, if the gospel came by works of the law, then it's not by a promise. And he says, but it did come through Abraham as a promise. And I think this is maybe the key for why does he go to Abraham? Why does he frame up the gospel as more than just the event of the cross, but a very promise of God? And I think it speaks to the very nature of the gospel. Because it's a promise, and especially a kind of unconditional promise, a gift promise, if you will, it undermines, the more we understand that, it undermines that temptation we all have to resort to works, to rule-keeping and works, to justify ourselves before God. You know, I think you're not likely clamoring, you know, for a return to Jewish ceremonial law this morning. So you might wonder, why am I banging on about this, let alone why is Paul, you know, 2,000 years hence? But I think we do all struggle. We struggle to maintain our understanding, our appreciation for the nature of the gospel. We struggle to trust in its power, and we sometimes forget its purpose. And so in our walk of faith, if you're a Christian this morning, you must not only become a Christian by the gospel, you must be maintained by the gospel. This is why Paul calls them back to look, to gaze upon the work of the cross. That helps us to maintain that sense of purpose and necessity of the gospel. It reminds us of who he is, that suffering servant that takes away, that takes upon us the curse and the sins of the world, and then gives to us the righteousness. When we understand, when we turn away from works of the law, and in appreciation serve the living God, and remind ourselves daily of the power of the gospel, then it gives us, I think, a right motivation. We're no longer motivated by doing. We're motivated by, one, the recognition of that suffering servant who loved me and gave himself for me. But then we're also recognizing that I need his power. I've hardly even talked about the Spirit this morning, but Paul has a lovely theology of the Spirit in this chapter, and he points again back to this in chapter 5 when he says, if you walk by the Spirit, you'll not fulfill the desires of your flesh. So there's a power, there's very power that comes inherent with the gospel. And then finally, understand the nature. That again keeps us humble. And if you want a test, a litmus test for how you're doing in your walk with Christ, are you trusting him? Are you staying on the back of Christ to walk you across your life and through your life? Then I think I'm going to turn our attention to our values. And in our value statement, we talk about the transforming power of the gospel. And we note it in three ways. It changes the way you see God, changes the way you see yourself, and changes the way you see others. And I think have that in mind. It's a really good litmus test. When you look at others, as God is maturing you, as he's sanctifying you in the faith, how do you see others? Do you see them as your equals? As co-laborers? Think of how Paul the great apostle, is, you know, he's spitting mad at these people, and yet seven times in this book he calls them brothers. Do you look at the person who has a different opinion with you in the same way? If not, then I suspect you're forgetting the very nature of the gospel, that it's a gift to you. If you're struggling with besetting sins, then are you relying on the power of the gospel? Are you relying on the power of repentance through the gospel, that gospel message that we always have to preach to ourselves, to just live by faith? In closing, I just want to quote from a great old hymn by James Proctor. And it's called, I think appropriately, "It Is Finished." He says, "Lay your deadly doing down, down at Jesus' feet. Stand in him alone, gloriously complete."